Good morning. Thank you for the introduction. I hope through my presentation I will get to the summit of Mount Stupid, but hopefully climb down with information that the audience can use and apply to the work that they do related to health equity. What I want to share with you today, the importance of health departments in preventing chronic diseases. I know that many of you do work in health departments at different levels, state health departments, local health departments, and even community-based organizations that may partner with the health departments. But oftentimes there is not a coordinated effort in the work that we do. But before I delve too further, I want to state that I have no relationships to disclose, and then jump straight into the objectives for this presentation. I will describe some of the roles of that some state health departments have used in chronic disease prevention, and also describe how cross-sectional collaborations are crucial to creating healthy, sustainable, and equitable places. Just to give you a little information on the burden of disease, or chronic disease in the United States, and this is all CDC data, it's not what Steve came up with, but in the United States, we know that more than 50% of adults 18 years and older have at least one chronic disease. And this accounts for about 70% of deaths in the United States by chronic diseases. So what we must do is look at the care and treatment of these chronic diseases and how it really costs the healthcare system. And so from that, we know that 86% of healthcare costs of the nation's $2.7 trillion annual healthcare expenditures come from chronic-related diseases. We know that the greatest predictors of chronic disease are tobacco use and exposure, physical inactivity, poor nutrition, lack of access to chronic disease prevention, risk reduction, and disease management opportunities. And these particular predictors of chronic disease is DHPE, in coordination with other national organizations, are working to address these areas through an initiative that we call Partnering for Health, and it's part of the greater project that CDC is implementing called Dissemination, National Dissemination of Information for Chronic Disease Prevention. And APA is one of the partners, along with APHA, the American Heart Association, and the National Association of WIC Directors. So back in 2012, DHPE, we conducted a survey of our members to really try to understand what do they feel that their role is in preventing chronic diseases. And the reason why we came up with this survey, because the role of our members, which traditionally served as health promotion unit directors, they were now taking on new roles. Some are chronic disease directors, some became directors of health equity, injury, so we really have a hodgepodge of members. So trying to figure out, well, you all work in different sectors, what is sort of common? What do you see your role now in the change of organizational structure of health departments? What percolated to the top of the list of this survey were that we see we have to administer funds, we receive millions of dollars that we have to get out into the community. But we also want to develop and implement programs that really reach the communities of that in greatest need, those vulnerable populations that you always hear us refer to. But also we need expertise in monitoring and evaluation. But what really caught our attention were the last two, and Kara highlighted this on her last slide, data-driven decisions. They felt that they had data, but they didn't have good data. And they were making decisions based on the traditional data that was collected by health departments, but they felt that there was other data out there that could help them make more informed decisions. And then trying to reach those populations that are most vulnerable with the equity approach, not just focusing on ethnic and racial minorities, but all populations that may be vulnerable to different chronic diseases. So Going back to the health department structure, they found that this was very difficult for them to do just because the way the health departments are structured. They structure working in silos. We know that we have chronic disease units at health department, which focus on obesity, diabetes, heart disease, asthma, and so forth. But you also have other parts of the health department that focus on infectious disease, environmental health, rural health, and oral health. But there oftentimes within the health department, there is not a coordinated approach to addressing some of these areas. So the first thing that we have to think about when we look at cross-sectoral collaborations is to approach it from a systemic orientation. And you may wonder, what is a systemic orientation? Our director at the director of health equity at the Ohio Department of Health, who is our member from Ohio and leads our health equity efforts from the member vantage of our organization, came up with, well, he didn't actually come up with it. Others came up with it. He sort of put it out there and got more traction. But systemic orientation is an approach, a way of thinking about public health work that focuses on connections among health-related problems, considers those connections when developing health policies, and align with those avenues of social change to ensure the condition in which all people can be healthy. And just in short terms, ensure there are equitable spaces for people to engage in health promotive activity. But this approach was developed in conjunction with HIV directors as they came to us and wanted to know how can they improve or enhance health equity in their work, but it's also applicable to health promotion units and chronic disease units at state health departments. Although we want to have equitable places throughout all communities, but there are challenges, and some of the challenges that were mentioned are categorical funding. We all know about categorical funding. We have asthma funding, we have heart disease funding. So we operate in silos, and we know that what gets funded is what gets done. There's not a lot of incentives to do cross-collaborative work. Also, how do we define equity and how do we define health equity? It may differ for one department within a health department, one division, and it also differs among different organizations. The way APA may define health equitable space or health equity may be very different from DHPE, but we have to come with a consensus on how do we define these equitable places of health equity. Also, there's no widespread support to build health equity in local and state health agencies. We oftentimes have one community-based organization working in one area, a local health department working in the other area, but there is really no infrastructure to coordinate all these efforts. So cross-sectoral collaboration is very important, such that if we're focusing on chronic diseases, we can also work with those community coalitions, those businesses and schools, in transportation and churches from a more collaborative approach in addressing health disparities and chronic diseases. So with a cross-sectional approach coupled with market research data, which I'm going to get into a little later, it helps us provide a clearer picture on how to create equitable spaces and address health equity. So coordinating all these activities among different sectors to collaborate on a single disease or a single health issue. What we have to focus on is getting to a shared vision, making those data-driven decisions with good data and not the traditional data that we normally collect through health departments. And also pulling together our resources. All organizations have different strengths that they can share and build upon when we come together as a coalition. So one of the projects that we have implemented at DHPE is our Community Marketed Analysis Project. And we are working with 12 state departments of health and a tribal organization to provide innovative approaches to plan and design effective health programs. We do this by integrating social determinants of health into health programs, doing, we analyze resources that are in the community, looking at the built environment, but also creating maps that target communities and populations and help those communities and populations develop and implement impact assessments. So once a project is implemented using this market research data, how can we go back and know that it really made an impact? So this graph, map of the United States just shows some of the states that we have worked with this project through 2014. But what we, when we work with the states on this project, we look at the social determinants of health, and this report from CDC, from the MMWR, this is a 2013 report that highlighted, but it looked at health disparities and inequalities in health, but related to major areas such as social determinants of health, poverty, education, and economic opportunity. Also looked at access to health care and some of those morbidity outcomes that we want to focus on, or we do focus on, chronic disease prevention, such as diabetes, hypertension, and then looked at behavior outcomes such as smoking. So getting to the point that the first presenter talked about data, health departments normally are able to track or map data down to the county level. And that is good information. Sometimes it's the best that we have, and it depends on the funding that states may receive. But in order to really get a clearer picture of what's going on in the community, it would be very helpful if we could drill down to the census tract level or the census block group level or even the census block level. That way you get a more clear and concise picture of what is going on in the neighborhood. There's less opportunity for variations within the population. So as you drill down to the census block group level, you really get a clear picture, and those individuals have proven to be more effective. So what do we? What does market research data tells us? It gives us demographic and SES socioeconomic status data, as well as household characteristics at a very small geographic level. What is the income of the household for a particular community? What are those activities or products that people within a very defined community are likely to participate in? And where should you target your efforts, but also when should you target your efforts? And what is in those communities that are the resources or the assets? Are there parks there? Are there areas where you could easily get transportation there, or public transportation? And area that I really like to highlight is, how do you reach that audience you're trying to provide these interventions for? So we look at market segments that are created through different companies that you have that are in exhibit halls that are free to state health departments to use, and anyone can use their public data sources. And so it really helped us create a portrait of the customer, of the consumer. Who are they? What are they like? Where can I find them? And how we can find them? And how can we reach them? And so it's helped us to see the importance and how to understand and predict behavior that can impact health. For an example, it's nice to know that we're trying to do tobacco prevention, but if we know in a certain community at a census block level, where are the tobacco vendors, but not just where they're located, what are the times of the month people are really purchasing tobacco, but not just the times of the month, who in that community is making those tobacco purchases? Is it the older population or younger population? So we see the variation. That way, when we're developing collaborations and coalitions, we know exactly which partners we should include in our coalition. So I want to provide an example of one of the states that we work with, looking at a chronic disease, diabetes, and how we use market research data to help develop a coalition and address this issue in Kentucky. Just a little more information from CDC about the burdens of diabetes in the United States. We know that nearly 10% of the U.S. population is impacted by diabetes. Nearly 25 million people in the United States may have or be undiagnosed with diabetes. And we know that 1.9% of people over the age of 20 or older were newly diagnosed with diabetes in the U.S. in 2010. Drilling down to Kentucky, what does this mean for Kentucky? It means that nearly just over 10% of the state population may have diabetes, and it costs the state $3.85 billion U.S. dollars in medical and indirect society costs. This is just one state. So drilling down a little further, we have a picture of what's going on in the state. So let's look at a particular community in Kentucky. And we're going to look at Fayette County, Kentucky, where they're based on their data from their 2015 diabetes report, that there are nearly 80,000 people 21 years or older who may be at risk for diabetes. So we want to know, well, how do we actually reach these individuals? And so we also know in Fayette County, Kentucky, that nearly half of adults 65 years and older are estimated to be pre-diabetic. So you have a young population and an older population that are at risk for diabetes that may be part of this 80,000 residents of Fayette County, Kentucky. And then we know that obesity is an indicator for risk for diabetes. And just under a third of Fayette County, Kentucky is described or characterized as obese. Also, we know that risk factors for diabetes are being African American, having no college education, and households that earn less than $25,000 per year. And so looking at diabetes prevention programs that oftentimes are implemented by the state, but they're in communities. So we know that we have an issue related to a chronic disease, diabetes, but how do we get people to use these diabetes prevention programs across the state? So what the state did, or what we worked with the state to identify private entities to who could work as life coaches in these diabetes prevention programs, but also design ways to help incorporate physical activity, healthy eating into areas where there may be a population at increased risk for diabetes. And this slide basically describes some of the scaling up that the diabetes prevention programs nationally are trying to do. But you can see, one, to raise awareness among population, but two, there's a clinical component where they're trying to connect businesses that provide health benefits, so that if there is a worker that may be at risk or may have diabetes, they can get into the diabetes prevention programs, but also increase referrals and where to market our activities related to diabetes prevention. So for those who may not be familiar with the state, such as myself, this is where Fayette County, Kentucky is located. And then when we drive down to lower levels of geography, we can see federally qualified health centers that are located throughout Fayette County, Kentucky. If those are most likely places in this particular county where these diabetes prevention programs are located. So thinking back on what the slide that I had up previously, where states have lots of data down to the zip code level, and you probably hear us talk about it at this conference, you know, zip codes should not predict life expectancy or disease outcomes. But when you drill down a little further using census track data, you can see that there's more of a concentrated area. So where should this diabetes prevention program through the state target their areas? So the darker brown areas show those pockets where they should target, but looking at the zip code, you would not think that there were areas that may be south that they should target. Also, another risk factor that I mentioned, being African American, based on zip code data, this is where African Americans mostly reside in Fayette County, Kentucky. But when you look at the census tracts level, you can see the darker area where the effort should be more concentrated, and then doing the dollar analysis, and then knowing where those federally qualified health centers are located that provide diabetes prevention education programs, those are the areas where we should target. Also, consumption of fresh fruits and vegetables, another indicator for diabetes development. And so you can see how we drill down to where People who are likely to consume more fresh fruits and vegetables are located by census tract level. So using all this information, looking at indicators for sedentary lifestyle, watching 45 hours for TV per week, so it gives you more of a clear picture of where to focus their efforts. So working with the Kentucky Department of Health, we're able to come up with certain segments within that area where they should target their efforts. And we found out that within this part of Fayette County, Kentucky, that the highest number of adults per household that listened to a radio Monday through Friday was from 6 a.m. to 10 a.m. So some of those public service announcements that they had planned to use because the radio stations that they can do it for free at midnight would not reach the target population. So that's a way that we have good intentions with our collaborations, knowing that someone can offer something which sounds good, we don't have to pay for it, but isn't really reaching the target population. Also, we know that individuals who may be at higher risk for diabetes that live in Fayette County, Kentucky, 60% of them on their own a computer, but 50% have access to the internet, and about 21 of 100 households use the internet via cell phone. So if we're trying to target doing sending out text messages, it may not be better. It may be better to try to figure out how we can get information through the internet. So we were able to work with the Diabetes Prevention Programs to connect their efforts with work with primary care providers who could make those referrals to the federally qualified health centers. Also, through collaborations, identifying large employers who may offer health benefits and could also direct individuals to where these diabetes prevention programs were located. Because we know that areas of increased risk for diabetes are age 65 and older, they were able to connect with senior centers in order to market where they could get information on how to prevent diabetes, and also looking at the density of fast food restaurants, food swamps, that we are that where they could target their efforts and try to provide opportunities to have opportunities to engage or obtain fresh fruits and vegetables, access to grocery stores. And then we are also able to identify areas where that it may not be a park, but some fitness centers were willing to let individuals come in and use those facilities for free. Some were through schools and through joint use agreements. So those were different strategies that a collaborative approach used to look at diabetes prevention. So some of the conclusions that I would like to make, that the, to locate the highest groups, the most vulnerable population, we need to drill down a little further so we know which people or which organizations we should approach in our coalitions as we implement a cross-sectoral approach. Also identifying the media that's most likely to reach that high-risk population that we're going to focus on in our collaborative approaches. And also locate primary care providers who are willing to make those referrals to diabetes prevention centers programs. So in conclusion, that we know that the sum is greater than a whole, and that we all must work together, not in silos, in order to improve health outcomes of the most vulnerable populations that we serve. Thank you.
Those were great presentations. Thank you, Dr. Owens. When Dr. Owens was speaking, I thought about the fact that Young was talking about relationships, and I think that's key as a planner or a public health official. As you go back to your communities, I challenge you to look for ways that you can. And before you leave, we are going to have question and answer, so I know some of you may be headed to your next session, but I hope you made some notes and have some questions for our presenters, because we do have about 15 minutes for Q&A. But I was just going to say, when you go back to your communities, if you have a wellness council or a health council, look for ways that you can be involved as a public health official, and you may already be involved, but those are great ways to develop those relationships in your communities. And then by using the information that Dr. Owen shared about drilling down to where the greatest needs are, and then how do we best reach those populations, I think those are key. So does anyone have any questions for our panelists? If you do, just raise your hand. Well, I have a question that I noted. I know that when Mary was presenting, she talked about the RAND study, and she mentioned that it was very important. And I was just wondering if she could elaborate on that for us. I think you do.
Sure. The RAND study is really one of the first studies that is looking at doing observations of public parks across all ages and across cities of various populations. They're working in partnership with the City Parks Alliance. And the reason that it's so important is really twofold. One is that it's coming up with some really interesting information, some really revealing stuff for park planners. For instance, the fact that walking paths were actually where the greatest amount of physical activity was taking place in the parks, and yet walking paths was one of the fewest facilities found in parks that they were looking at. So what an incredible disconnection that this is one of the most active places and one of the fewest facilities in public parks. You know, I take that to mean that we should be putting walking paths every time we're building a public park, and connections between places to get to that public park so people don't have to drive to the park to take a walk. And the second reason is it's so important is that it is refining and zeroing in on the best data collection methods. In the past, research on the built environment has been a little challenging because in order to isolate factors, it's tough to do because they're public spaces and there's a lot of mitigating factors. And this study is actually finding ways to really focus in, key in, and get at the kind of data that we need as planners to produce healthier places.
I have one more question for Mary. We a lot of times we see a lot of parks, but we don't have people in those parks. And I was wondering if Mary and also our other panelists might want to touch on how do we get the folks that to be more active and maybe get into those parks.
Sure. So this happens, I don't know about your community, but this happens all the time. I drive by a park and there's no one in it, and I think, what are we doing? Or what are we doing wrong? I think one of the ways to get people into the parks is to activate the park somehow. And that means bringing programs into the parks. And because remember that people need seek out other people. We know from actually research that's been done in wilderness areas that even people who go to park settings to get away from it all end up being in the same place as other people in that setting. So really, people do seek out other people. So if you can activate that park and get people to that park, other people will come to that park. But the second response I have to that is that remember that we know that those parks, even when they're empty, are providing environmental health benefits, and that views of nature are providing stress reduction and health benefits to people, even when they are just on the outside looking in. So one of the ways that you see in Chicago, this isn't strictly park related, but the former mayor did a lot of work on landscapes and medians, and because it was his belief that looking at beautiful things made people happier. And so I remember one time driving on Lakeshore Drive and being in a traffic jam. And instead of my usual aggravation and being in a traffic jam, I happened to have my window open, and along the median to my left was a bed of roses, knockout roses. And I could smell those roses because, of course, I wasn't moving. I was in a traffic jam. And it made me so calm. I mean, I wasn't mad anymore. So remember that parks, even if it doesn't have people in them being active, do provide other benefits from a health perspective.
I have a story. In Milwaukee, there's a large park located on the north side of Milwaukee, and no one really uses it, partly because there are no crosswalks leading into the park. And years ago, the way the city of Milwaukee decided to put in a crosswalk would be to just count the cars. Well, if you saw one car per hour, but 500 children trying to get across, you know, they would still not put in a crosswalk because they were just counting cars. And so a group of teenage young women took a video of themselves trying to cross this busy street to get to a park. They created a film, and at a public meeting where there were some city planners, they showed them the film of them just trying to get across the street to the park. And it was quite effective, and they got a crosswalk that summer.
Okay, yes, ma'am.
Yeah, first of all, I want to commend you for honoring the community and honoring the farmers the way that you do, and fabulous. And the model that you have of relationship-based funding versus problem-based funding is beautiful. I want to ask if you have worked at all with Fair Share CSA, which I know is in Madison, but for
I'm not familiar with.
Can you restate the question?
Yeah. So, am I familiar with Fair Share CSA in Madison, Wisconsin? And what was the other part of the question? We have not. Yes, CSAs. Everyone know what CSAs are? Community shared, community supported agriculture. We have not found CSAs to work real well in our neighborhood, mainly because it requires a payment up front. And so that's the big barrier.
Yes, Fair Share CSA.
Fair Share CSA.
It's in Madison.
Uh-huh.
They've gotten insurance, health insurance, to give subsidies, to give vouchers.
Okay.
To pay for the CSA.
Wow.
Yeah.
That is an innovative, because the insurers have to realize that there's a payoff down the road. We are ourselves looking at vegetable prescriptions, where a family will get a prescription of vegetables with vouchers that are good at a farmer's market so that they can. And that's being done in New York City, I think Baltimore, some other cities. So there are lots of ways to, I think, encourage people to come out to farmer's markets and eat more vegetables.
Great, thank you. There was another question. Did I see another hand? Let's see where we are. I had one more question, if we have just a moment. I was wondering about youth in our communities, and in your background and experience in the work that you do, have you seen successes involving youth in either farmers markets or in just the issue of active living and health?
When it comes to youth and agriculture, there's a very innovative program nearby called Alice's Garden. And It's run by an African American woman who it's a 2-acre gardening plot. She has purposefully gone about trying to mend the rift between much of the population that lives in Milwaukee and agriculture. Substantial portion of the Milwaukee African American population moved to Milwaukee to get away from farming. To get away from farming first via the Underground Railroad and then later to get away from sharecropping. A lot of people, older folks in Milwaukee still say we moved here so that we would never have to farm again. And for someone to come in and say, we're going to help you grow your own food without really looking at some of the history is kind of a not a good thing to do. So, there is a growing group of youth in our neighborhood that are growing and selling at our farmers market. They're growing, doing value-added products with herbs and herbs and teas, and you know they're doing some pretty innovative stuff. But first, you have to talk about some of the unpleasant stuff, and urban agriculture is not necessarily new. I mean, people have been growing stuff in their backyards for a long, long time, but they never called it urban agriculture. They just grew stuff because they liked to grow stuff. But it wasn't really recognized as urban agriculture. It was, people were just crusaders coming into a community trying to save people. So,
Are there any other questions from the audience? Well, if not, let's give our panelists a round of applause.